At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are, and welcome to the Politics Guys with your hosts, Jay Parson and Michael Baranowski.
Welcome to the Politics Guys. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. My co-host this week, as always, is Cleveland area attorney and sometime Republican strategist Jay Carson. Who won the 2016 presidential election? I thought it was a pretty much answered question, but it seems like so much else in American politics these days, the answer you'll get depends on who you ask.
Nothing is over until we say it.
Exactly.
Otter, I think, said.
Otter?
Or was it Bluto?
Bluto. It was Bluto, actually. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I hadn't thought about that reference. Now, what we do know is that more people overall voted for Hillary Clinton, over 2 million more at this point, which is around 2% more of the popular vote than Donald Trump got. Now, until this week, we thought we knew that that didn't matter because Donald Trump had won more electoral votes, 306 to Clinton's 232, which counting Michigan, which just a few days ago declared Trump the winner by just over 10,000 votes. But now, the vote in three critical states that could flip the election, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, is being challenged. Not, as you might expect, by Hillary Clinton's campaign or the Democratic Party, but by Green Party nominee Jill Stein, who this last week has raised over $5 million for the costs associated with recounts in those three states. So Jay, what do you make of this? Why is Jill Stein, of all people, doing this? And what do you think is likely to come of it?
Well, I think Jill Stein's doing it because this is the most we've ever talked about Jill Stein and the most anyone's ever talked about Jill Stein over the last year, despite the fact that she ran for president. I think it is primarily a Green Party sort of publicity stunt. I don't think there's much merit there. As most of our listeners probably know, this comes out of there was a report by some computer science people who said, look, we think there's a possibility there could have been hacking. Now, again, there's absolutely no evidence that there's been any hacking.
Well, yeah, they were even more kind of circumspect about that. They said, well, there are some things that we don't really think there's an issue, but just to make absolutely sure, it might not be a bad idea if there's a recount. But even they said that
But you don't say that kind of thing. That's sort of the. You don't say, well, it's like if you go to the doctor and they see something on your scans or something and, well, you know, look, it's probably not cancer. I wouldn't worry about it, but, you know, most likely not cancer. But, you can't just go and say stuff like that. Obviously, these folks, before they issued a press release, were intending that there would be a recount or they were intending to call the result into doubt. They just put enough caveats in there to try to safeguard their professional reputation.
I disagree. I see what you're saying, but I don't think it was nearly that political. I just think it was data scientist type people kind of doing the sort of thing they do and saying, this is interesting. But then again, yeah, I think you tend to politicize these things more than
what would you expect would happen though?
As an academic, when I say anything about anything, I expect nothing will happen, and that's generally exactly what does happen. So, I think it's not – I don't think that their motives were nearly as political as you do. But I do think certainly that they were politicized and they were taken out of context and sensationalized by the left to gin up some controversy where I don't really think there is any. Now, that said, I should point out that Donald Trump won those three states by not that many votes. In Wisconsin, a little over 22,000. Michigan, just over 10,000. Now, Pennsylvania, a little bit bigger state, a little over 70,000. So, that's not a lot of votes, but still, and this is what these folks pointed out, is that there would have to be it would be enormously unlikely that any recount would give Clinton a victory in any of these states, which is why I think the Clinton, you know, the Clinton campaign says, yeah, we'll be part of this, but they weren't pushing for this. And, you know, the reason why is because they know it's not going to change the results.
Yeah. Well, more to the point, I think, if the real concern is, oh, there's been hacking, to what extent does a recount really even solve that problem? Yeah. And that's going to depend on, you know, I guess how each state, you know, records its votes. You know, those states that have electronic voting to begin with, you know, I think if you recount, you'll get the same results you did before. And if they were hacked then, they're hacked now.
Well, and I think, too, people have this idea of hacking from movies and, you know, and TV and so forth, and just think that some, you know, Russian super genius team can go in and go online and connect to all these voting machines. That's not how it works. It's just not. It would take an enormously coordinated effort where people would actually have to have access to these voting machines. I mean, it is so highly improbable to be not exactly laughable, but just the idea that
I'm laughing.
Yeah, like you're laughing, sure.
Right now, literally, yeah.
But and so that to me, you know, and this is to me the irony, I guess, is that there were so many liberal media outlets who were aghast, who were outraged, maybe fake outraged, I don't know, at the thought that Donald Trump might not accept the legitimacy of the election. And of course, Donald Trump has no problem accepting the legitimacy of the election now, but it's they who don't have a problem or who have a problem accepting it. And I find that, I mean, it's, you know, it's not all of the liberal media, but some pretty prominent outlets who are, you know, kind of egging this on. I don't know. I think mainly they're doing it just because, you know, controversy sells, and that's what their readers want to believe, is that they were robbed. But the fact of the matter is while Hillary Clinton did get a lot more votes overall, that's not how our system works. It's like the losing team, you know, in a football game saying, well, we have more total yards than the other team. But that's not exactly the point, yeah. You know? So, see, to me, that's not the real concern. That's not what I'm concerned about. I am concerned about the fact that there are plenty of media outlets who don't seem to have a problem casting doubt on the legitimacy of our elections for their own, you know, for their own financial gain. But to me, a bigger concern is a number of independent reports that make it pretty clear that Russia put forth a massive propaganda disinformation effort, largely through social media, with thousands of these bots and, you know, big teams of what are called trolls and website networks and so forth, to just push out so much fake and almost all anti-Clinton information. Now, did that have an effect? That's one of those things that's really hard to measure. It certainly didn't help Hillary Clinton. But to me, the real concern is that I don't know how much of a defense we have against this sort of tampering in our elections, and I think it's a big concern, and we don't have any good answers for it right now. I'm not deeply worried, because I am kind of deeply worried about that. I don't know. What do you think, Jay?
I think the best defense is you just sort of look at these stories that come out, and if it sounds like crazy propaganda, it probably is.
I agree.
You know, I mean, the Russians have been putting out sort of crazy propaganda into the U.S. in one form or another for decades and decades now. And it used to be that liberals would make fun of conservatives for, you know, pointing out, you know, so many of the – don't get me started about, you know.
Well, I think except now there are a couple differences. Number one, I think the Russians have gotten a lot more sophisticated in the type of propaganda they put out. It's not the kind of crazy Pravda type stuff that we saw in the, you know, in the 80s and 90s.
Right.
It's a lot more sophisticated. Number two, they have a much better dispersal mechanism, which is social media. And plenty of people believe some of these stories, which take something that's true or true enough, like, for instance, Hillary Clinton's questionable ethics on certain things or her falling ill, and just spinning that just enough into something that's untrue but believable if you're maybe on the fence. And I think there's – I don't know that there's any great defense for this. You know, Facebook says they're trying to focus on cracking down on fake news. But this is, to me, one of the fundamental problems when you have an open society and an open media like this with essentially not as many real gatekeepers anymore to information, is that somebody who wants to do damage can flood the system with fake information that is very compelling, you know, those kind of clickbaity sort of headlines. People love this sort of stuff, and so it plays right into people's weaknesses.
I guess my sense is a lot of people, you click on it, but do you believe it? I don't.
But
the defense I would recommend to everybody is you'd be skeptical of everything you see, whether it's, just a silly clickbait type thing coming from someone on social media or whether it's coming from the New York Times.
I agree. I think you and I, we certainly do that. And I bet you that our listeners do that. But my concern is with, the vast majority of Americans who...
Those idiots who don't listen.
Exactly. We need a few hundred million more listeners and we would be fine. But that's really my concern. And that's not going away. In fact, I think that problem, I don't know if it's going to get worse, but I think certainly... the Russians aren't going to stop doing that. And there's no reason why other actors won't do that, like the Chinese and some other governments. And so that's a real concern going forward. And I don't have a good answer for it.
Yeah, I think it's sort of being a little overblown. I think the news media takes any sort of threat to its own turf extremely seriously and tends to blow up more than maybe is warranted. And again, I mean, I'm not sure exactly which clickbaity stories they're talking about, but I get all kinds of crazy stuff in my news feed, and I would say I ignore the vast majority of it. And I guess that's the defense, and maybe it's just an immunization process that people need to work through on social media. I think it's a little different than our parents or grandparents. Generations where, look, if they said it on TV or it was printed in the paper, well, it has to be true.
Sure.
I think most younger people, Gen Xers and millennials, have sort of more of a built-in skepticism for the media in general and for what they see online in particular.
Well, so. I will end this by saying that you seem to have a lot more faith in the public's common sense and rationality than I do, and I hope you're right. Assuming Donald Trump is sworn in on January 20th, which I'm going to go out the limb and say is a safe assumption, we're starting to get more of a sense of what his team, what his plans will look like. In the last week, the president-elect has released two videos to YouTube, bypassing the media entirely. I watched both of them. They're very short. His video at the beginning of the week covered his main priorities that he wants to cover once he's in office. And then on Thanksgiving, he released a video that essentially called for everyone to sort of come together after a brutal and hugely polarizing campaign. And he also met with the New York Times, where he seemed to moderate a number of his campaign positions. And he ended the meeting by saying, "It's a great honor. I will say the Times is a great, great American jewel, a world jewel, and I hope we can all get along. We're working for the same thing, and I hope we can all get along well." It's like, who is this guy? Jay, what did you think about Donald Trump's messages to the American public, his meeting with the New York Times? Any thoughts on that?
Well, I think going straight to YouTube, I think, is sort of brilliant. I mean, He's taken advantage of this new medium to get around media, which is, hostile to him. And I think he's doing it well now. And it's a little weird that he does it well on YouTube as opposed to the goofy Twitter posts where, he's complaining about Hamilton or complaining about Saturday Night Live or those sort of things, which, again, strike me as being very unpresidential. But you're using the medium wrong. But no, I think it's great. And again, the media is in a little bit of a freak out over, sort of wait, he can't do this. But yes, he did. And I mean, I guess I'd draw a comparison to, and you'll probably freak out, and a lot of liberals will freak out. But FDR, who used the medium of radio and the fireside chats to speak directly to the American public and again, bypassing traditional media and getting to people right in their homes, right where they live, and speaking to them directly. He's really doing the same sort of thing. albeit even in a much, much shorter version.
Well, I think that's the smart thing is that it's a lot. He understands the brief attention span of the public. From all accounts, he himself has a very brief attention span. And so he keeps these things short and snappy. But, you know, there was a lot, at least in the video released that he released not quite a week ago. You could get a lot from what he wanted to do. You know, he talked about putting America first, creating jobs, withdrawing from TPP, the same sort of stuff we heard on the campaign, essentially. A couple of new things. One thing he mentioned is he wanted to formulate a rule that says for every one new regulation, two old regulations must be eliminated. He mentioned wanting the Department of Defense and the Joint Chiefs of Staff to develop a plan to protect infrastructure against cyber attacks and all other forms of attacks. And also, he talked about that five-year ban on executive branch officials lobbying and also a lifetime ban on lobbying foreign governments. So there were a few newish kind of things. But again, we pretty clearly see him in all of this being a lot less adversarial than he was during the campaign, though given how adversarial he was, it's hardly a surprise because he could hardly
And also, at this point, he doesn't really have an adversary yet.
Yeah, exactly.
There will be Democrats in Congress once these things are actually put into place in terms of an actual proposal that's moving forward in Congress. He'll have actual adversaries. But there's the little bit of a – I mean, I don't know whether you call it a honeymoon period or what, but he gets to speak and there's not really an adversary on the field at this point.
Good point. I mean, we've seen even, you know, in some of his tweets in reaction to the Jill Stein election challenge, and pretty clearly he's not coming out as strongly as he did for some stuff during the campaign. But, you know, that's the old Donald Trump that we've come to expect, certainly, in some of those tweets. And you can see that's an excellent point. You know, also, I should mention that the president-elect also filled out his administration a little bit more this week. He announced his choices for education secretary and ambassador to the United Nations. His pick for education is Betsy DeVos, a major Republican fundraiser who, unsurprisingly, is a critic of public schools and a big proponent of vouchers and school choice. Nikki Haley, his UN pick, is currently governor of South Carolina. She was a strong critic of Donald Trump during the campaign. And, you know, he's also asked another former opponent, surgeon and former Republican presidential candidate Ben Carson, to run the Department of Housing and Urban Development, though Carson, at least at the point we're recording this, hasn't indicated that he'll accept the position. So I'm wondering, Jay, what do you think about these choices? What do you think they say about Donald Trump and what we might expect in the Trump administration?
I would say these are pretty much, you know, first the Betsy DeVos one, that's probably the most controversial. But I would say it's not surprising. I personally had never heard of Betsy DeVos before this, but it's not surprising that he would select someone like her. You know, and the other name that had been bandied about a lot for education secretary was Michelle Rhee. Who is a similar big proponent of vouchers, charter schools, alternatives to traditional public education. Look, as a conservative, I think that's fantastic. There's sort of a myth on the left that what conservatives want to do is just tear apart public education, destroy it altogether, and so forth. And I can tell you from my dealings in this, no, quite honestly, what they want to do is break up the systems that aren't working. And the best way to do that is through competition. And that's the particular problem is with a lot of these inner city districts where people are condemned to, you know, you're stuck with a really bad school system. I think vouchers and charter schools, while imperfect, can have a discussion about charter schools someday, but it's a choice, and having a choice is better than having no choice. So
well, what about this? I mean, another trend that we're kind of, there are a couple trends that I see in Donald Trump's picks. One, The first one I'll mention, I guess you talked about freaking out some people. I'll freak out some people too by saying that, you know, some have argued that Donald Trump is taking kind of a team of rivals approach that was that's sort of along the lines of what President Lincoln did. I'm sure people will love it.
He is nothing if not Lincoln-esque.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but I mean that
in fairness, I mean, if you look back, Lincoln was very much criticized for the type of stuff, I mean, albeit different level that the Trump is, but sort of being a vulgar sort of frontier, rough talking, not polite society type character.
Well, yeah, and certainly Trump is that. Just for people, just to be clear, what we're talking about, this team of rivals approach, and the idea is that you bring in a number of people who don't necessarily agree, who are going to kind of go at it, and you let them do that, and that creative energy will give you more and better solutions than if you just sort of surround yourself with yes people, essentially, or in kind of a presidential bubble. And from many accounts, that's sort of how Donald Trump has run many of his businesses, is he likes to create that conflict. There's a surprise, and sort of he feeds off of that energy, and he gets to be, as one of our former presidents would call it, the decider. And you know, I think there's something to be said for that approach if you can take it too far and just end up having chaos. But I would expect that under, for instance, a Hillary Clinton administration, you wouldn't see that at all. It's a very, very big difference. And that's been a problem with a lot of presidents, is that they surround themselves with people who only tell them what they want to hear, everyone who has the sort of same worldview, the same ideology, and they get locked into that and kind of tunneled in there. And that's a bad thing. And so, you know, Am I grasping at straws here? I don't know, but I guess I'm saying that certainly.
Well, a little bit of it is also the fact that Trump himself doesn't or hasn't appeared so far to have any real overreaching ideology. So I think it kind of makes it easier for him to pick sort of just menu of here's this guy, here's this guy, here's this guy, and they don't necessarily agree, because it's almost like Trump himself doesn't have an overriding policy that with which he agrees. He sort of needs these people to sort it out for him.
Well, and there's another concern there, is that will he just simply listen to agree with the last person he hears from? You know, and so that's one of the problems when I think you don't have a kind of a deep background, is that people who can make persuasive arguments, you know, the last persuasive argument you hear might be the one you go with. And that's why I think, as a general rule, while I think a sort of a team of rivals approach is good, I think it works best when you have somebody in charge who has kind of a depth of experience, who's really thought about some of these things, who can kind of weigh these things a little more. Again, I hope I'm wrong about that, but it's certainly a different type of approach. A couple other things I've noticed is, number one, or number two, I guess, is that he's picked a number of people who don't necessarily have a lot of experience. Ben Carson would be a great example. I mean, Ben Carson, as far as I know, hasn't run anything of any size, and which I think it's smart for Ben Carson to hesitate.
He was, I think, the head medical director of a hospital, I believe it.
Okay, so that's a far cry from a cabinet level department, and right. So that's an enormous administrative task. And do you want to put somebody in that job with no experience? Nikki Haley's another example. She has no real foreign policy experience. She's a governor. And so, I mean, that's kind of the difficulty you face. If you want people who come in with new ideas and new approaches, oftentimes they're not the people who've had experience at running these organizations. Their learning curve is going to be a lot steeper. And the concern is that they're going to be even more liable to being controlled by the career bureaucrats who essentially run these agencies, who've been there forever and are going to be there forever. And so that's a potential, you know, a potential negative of that. And what do you think, Jay?
I'm going to say some conservative stuff that might put some people off. But
as it should,
you know, in terms of the three things we're talking about right now, the Department of Education, Housing and Urban Development, and UN Ambassador, those are all things which most conservatives would say, does it really matter who's in charge? The conservative vision for the Department of Education, the true conservative vision, I think, for the Department of Education is that there is no federal Department of Education. Just let states do it. See, I knew I'd get people worked up. I think, look, if you're expecting Betsy DeVos to do something radical one way or another, I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think she's going to do much. I don't think the department's going to do much. But it's a change in, it signals a change in attitude. Housing and urban development, actually, though, is one that I think there is a lot of are a lot of things that, that HUD can do that it's not doing and can do better. Ben Carson concerns me as he seems to be a very, very nice person. But other than that, again, I'm not sure what his qualifications are, what sort of big ideas he has coming into that. Now, maybe it's just, again, the change of attitude, and he's going to listen to ideas coming from other folks, which otherwise might not have gained an audience. And Nikki Haley, same thing with the UN. There is less of a concern of what is she going to do on her own, because UN ambassador, it's you really tend to have a fairly short leash, and it's more just the change in attitude, change in marching orders. So I, you know, with those three pricks in particular, I don't see a huge policy change coming. Just because, one, I think the conservative idea, and if they follow a conservative idea, is that, that, you know, none of those agencies are going to do a whole heck of a lot. But it signals that there is a new attitude, and maybe they're more circumspect about what they do do.
You know, one other thing that I've noticed is that, especially in terms of foreign policy picks, that he seems to be leaning a lot toward former generals, especially a number of Marine generals, which, of course, as a Marine, I sort
gotta
of
like
a,
that, right?
Well, here's the thing: I do and I don't. I mean, my sort of visceral reaction is, yes, we need more Marines in the foreign policy establishment. But then I think, wait, do we actually need that? I mean, there's this tradition of civilian control of the military, and if you have too many people who are military folks who are in charge in these foreign policy positions, is that a matter for concern? Some people say, yeah, it could make our foreign policy more bellicose than it would otherwise be. On the other hand, there are some folks who say, well, maybe generals are the people who are going to be most reluctant to bring us into these, to suggest that we get involved in warfare, because they more than civilians would understand the costs of that. I don't know. What do you think, Jay?
Well, you know, first of all, I think there's a lot more to foreign policy than wars. And that's, so again, that's sort of the, you know, the sexiest part of the whole thing. But
so to speak,
you know, by and large, what the State Department does on a day-to-day basis isn't figuring out, you know, who are we going to have a war with and who aren't we going to have a war with. But it's a lot just of managing the status quo of people moving back and forth, of goods and services moving back and forth, maintaining relationships. There is an intelligence collecting piece of that where you work hand in hand with the intelligence agencies. You know, so in large part, you know, what you need is good management. And I think the generals would probably be good for that. And to the extent they bring a clear-eyed real world view, I think that's good. I'm not overly concerned that you know, we're going to turn it into some sort of, you know, military you know, like Turkey or Egypt or something like,
sure,
that, where you have a military class that sort of runs the government. And I think it might be beneficial. I mean, it might be sort of something of a tonic to the, you know, what we've had so far. And you know, look, it remains to be seen. I mean, different generals obviously and different members of the military look at problems differently. So the idea that every general, and this is, again, something that's, you know, sort of been foisted upon us by the left, I mean, back from the, you know, the Dr. Strangelove kind of days, is that, you know, every general, they want to start a war. And I think realistically, most people would think that's really not the case.
I guess I'd also point out that a lot of people have an idea of what a general is that is very much, you know, framed by, again, movies and TV and popular culture. But generals are very much politicians. You don't get those stars on your shoulder without being a very political animal and understanding a lot of that stuff. These are not just sort of crazed warmonger type folks. And so they're very, very different in many cases from how people think of them, I think, or at least how a lot of people think
of them. And again, I think one of the key things that you look at, it's not necessarily military brilliance, tactical, like, you know, okay, who takes this ground, who takes this, and, you know, that sort of thing that we like to think of. But there's a whole lot of just day to day of, you know, how do you get the logistics of this done? How do you get everything from A to B? How do you get everybody fed and clothed? And, you know, those types of things that are management responsibilities. So, you can, as someone who served, you can tell me how well, you know, military management works or doesn't work, but.
I think it's variable, but yeah, I think your larger point is very important. One is generals are in terms of their day to day activities, they're much more politicians and managers as opposed to warriors.
How do we keep enough gas for all the trucks? How do we, you know, it's that kind of thing. It's less than drawing up war plans on the map.
Yeah, thankfully we don't have to do a ton of that all the time. You know, before we move on to our next story, I'd like to thank our new supporters this week. First, we have Scott from – well, actually, I don't know where Scott's from, but Scott's been a big supporter of the show from very early on. He comments a lot on Facebook, and he gave a very, very generous donation to the show this week, and we really appreciate that, Scott. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Scott.
Next, we have Chris from – I do know where Chris is from, Newport, New Hampshire. And Chris writes, I've met many politicians as a resident of New Hampshire. I bet you have. I take pride following politics and making an effort to get to know all the national candidates, especially when we meet them up close during our primary. I enjoy your show to follow both points of view. I'm a registered undeclared voter because I don't want anyone to assume I will vote for them. I try to vote considering both left and right sides, and your show is the best source to guide my decisions. I recommend your show when I can and appreciate your efforts.
Oh, thank you, Chris.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. And now, of course, if you're interested in supporting the show financially, you can do what Scott and Chris did. Just go to politicsguys.com and click on either the PayPal or Patreon donation links that we have up there. And as always, it would be a really big help if you could spread the word, share and retweet our new show posts on Facebook and Twitter, and leave reviews and ratings of the show on iTunes. Okay. On to our next story. You know, there's been a lot of talk about the potential for conflicts of interest and outright corruption in the Trump administration, especially this week. Donald Trump has said that he plans to turn over his business interests to his children, and that would be far from the sort of blind trust that other presidents have traditionally put their financial interest into before they moved into the White House. And there have been some media outlets, particularly on the left, who've argued that from day one, the Trump administration will likely be in violation of the Constitution, specifically the Emoluments Clause, which states, no person holding any office of profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of the Congress, accept any present emolument, office, or title of any kind whatever from any king, prince, or foreign state. So, Jay, is this really a big deal, or is it just people getting worried over nothing? What do you think?
Well, two things. First, Trump opponents will continue to charge him with conflicts of interest, with corruption, no matter what he does. I think that's going to be a theme for the next 4 years, and it just is what it is. There are ways that he probably could do this correctly. From a legal standpoint, the Wall Street Journal about a week ago had a good sort of prescription of Donald Trump. Here's what you need to do. Here's the way to walk through it. And he sort of just kind of blew that off. I'm trying to think what his actual comments were, but he indicated that he wasn't necessarily going to be following, you know, what the Wall Street Journal prescribed for him to do. Peggy Noonan, also in the Wall Street Journal, wrote a piece about, you know, is there a matter of Trump just doesn't get this, the difference between being a private business person and a public servant. And it maybe he just does it because it's the habits of a lifetime. And, you know, one of the examples is, you know, taking pictures with contractors who he's working with and so forth. And, you know, it's one thing to say, here he is, here's a contractor posing with the, you know, real estate mogul Donald Trump. And another thing to say, here's the president of the United States endorsing this person or that person, especially when some of these contractors are from our foreign nationals from foreign countries.
And we, know, should point, these... yeah, we should point out that Donald Trump is, you know, very unique in this sense. There are something like over 100 Trump companies that do business in 18 other countries, you know, in all parts of the world. And so I think that in some instances, conflicts are inevitable. Corruption isn't. But, you know, I agree. It's very problematic that Donald Trump seems to be and his team just seem to be saying, oh, don't worry about it. We'll take care of it and we'll follow the law and it'll be fine. It's not a concern. I mean, I don't think that's the right response to this at all.
No, they're going to need to come out with a bigger plan and a statement and a here's what we're going to do, I think, before the inauguration. To explain how they're going to work this. And again, the left will say that's not enough. But they need to do that. They need to have a plan just so that there is a plan and that they can say, listen, we've had lawyers, accountants, from both sides, from the private side, from the public side, people who specialize in ethics, public conflict of interest issues. Look at this, and here's what they've recommended, and here's what we're going to go with.
See, I think that would be great, but my concern is that one thing that Donald Trump has been particularly untransparent about is his business dealings. You know, the whole thing about his income tax returns, and you know, it just in a number of areas, it's pretty clear that he doesn't want anyone knowing anything more than what's absolutely necessary about the Trump Organization. And I think there are some understandable reasons for that. I think that he's made a lot of money by kind of skirting the edges of the law and maybe going over sometimes. And he is kind of, in a sense, Clinton-esque about this. Is I think his tendency to be too defensive about this is going to come back and bite him. I don't think that he's going to do what you think he should do and what I think he should do. And I think that's going to be a huge problem.
He's necessarily going to take my advice. He
should
so far.
Yeah, well, he should, you know, obviously. But yeah, I think
other cooler heads will push him on coming up with some sort of a plan that is going to be an announced. Here's what we're going to do.
I hope you're right, but I think on this, I don't think that's going to happen. But I hope you're right. Now, certainly Congress can act too, because in part of that clause, it says that, you know, Congress can in fact consent to various gifts, emoluments, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So, my sense is Congress wouldn't want to touch that.
Yeah. Well, I think that there are going to be people who are going to want Congress to weigh in to clarify that. But yeah, I don't think that's going to happen. I think you're right. They're going to try to stay as far as possible away from that sort of thing. So it's certainly something that the media is going to be following, and I am very glad for that, because unfortunately, since Democrats are a minority in both chambers, they won't be able to hold hearings. But I just hope that Donald Trump is held to account and kept as honest as the media and Democrats in Congress can keep him on this issue.
Yeah, the way to do it, and again, I don't think this is going to happen, but it would be cool if it did, is you set up a bipartisan commission to come up with a plan as to how do you do this. And they take, you know, whatever testimony. Now, again, the problem is to do it before the inauguration. You're just not going to have the time to do that, or the personnel to do that.
Or the political will.
Yeah. And you say, look, here is a bipartisan proposal. Democrats have signed off on this. Republicans have signed off on this. Mr. Trump, this is what we recommend that you do. And we will – you know, pass whatever legislation needs to be passed. Now, again, I don't think that will ever happen.
Well, Democrats have
because some, it's too big of a
yeah. Some Democrats have suggested legislation that they want to introduce about that, but it's not going to go anywhere in a Republican House or a Republican Senate for sure. But yeah, I agree with you. It would be nice to have some kind of clarification. So the next time we have a billionaire president with far flung business interests, you know, this will be covered.
And it could. I mean, if you consider like a Michael Bloomberg, I mean, that would present the same type of problem, same type of issues.
Sure, absolutely. You know, Barack Obama is still president of the United States. Hard to believe. We don't talk about it much these days. But while President-elect Trump and a Republican Congress may be able to undo much of President Obama's legacy, and President Obama's legacy is something we're definitely going to be talking about in upcoming Ask the Politics Guys, you know, one thing that they can't do is unpardon people. And President Obama has now pardoned more than 1,000 federal prisoners, which is more than any other president. And I would argue that even more importantly, under his administration, the Justice Department has been instructing federal prosecutors to not bring charges in mandatory minimum cases that involve low-level nonviolent drug crimes. And as a result, charges in these kind of cases have gone down by around 25%. And I think everyone can agree that it's a whole lot better to never be charged in the first place than to be charged, convicted, and then, you know, hope for clemency at some point. And right. So now that's my kind of liberal viewpoint or center-left viewpoint on this. What do you think, Jay? I mean, first off, I guess, is it a good thing that what President Obama and the Justice Department are doing, have been doing for years now? And more importantly, I guess, would you expect a Justice Department headed by Jeff Sessions, a very tough-on-crime kind of guy, to take a different approach to nonviolent low-level drug crimes?
I'm going to surprise people by saying I actually don't have that big of a problem with what Obama's doing. Here's what I'm trying to – again, it's the same thing of I think he's doing the right thing, perhaps doing it the wrong way. It's probably an abuse of the clemency process. And again, we're talking mostly about commuting of sentences rather than full pardons.
Right.
It's just a matter of saying, okay, look, you've done your time now, or we're lessening your sentence or something, which is clearly within his power to do. You know, but we do have a problem in our federal system, in our state systems too, of we have a mass incarceration of people, and it's extremely expensive and it doesn't seem to be working. And I look at this as a, you know, far right wing conservative that I am, and say, you know, regardless of if you want to be tough on crime, you want a policy that works and isn't just a massive government spending program that's not working. And I think in many cases, that's what we've achieved with these sentencing pieces that were put in, mostly in the early 90s in response to the crack epidemic, and are dragging in too many people. So, you know, look, I've got a little bit of a problem. Less of a problem with the commuting of sentences, because I think that's plenty within the presidential power. More of a problem with telling prosecutors not to bring charges across the board. I mean, again, there's prosecutorial discretion where they can make those decisions, but I think the president of the Justice Department making blanket orders on we're not going to prosecute these crimes is overreaching and in violation of what Congress wants you to do. But I think it's something the new Congress will have to take up, and I think Jeff Sessions might surprise you.
Well, I don't know, because, you know, he's very publicly, very clearly come out in favor of very strong enforcement of drug laws. He's come out very much opposed to Obama's approach to this. And his belief, in fact, that he said is that it's the kind of strict enforcement that we've had that has actually lowered crime rates. So I don't think he's going to surprise me at all. I think he's going to just reverse course. And I think that's going to be a disaster for the criminal justice system, at least at the federal level. And it's going to cause, you know, unnecessary suffering and financial pain as well for a lot of people. And one of the many reasons why I think Jeff Sessions is an awful pick for Attorney General.
Well, let's take a look, though, again, at what Jeff Sessions is going to be authorized to do. And to some extent, if there's going to be changes, they're going to come from Congress. And I think there will be changes coming from Congress.
Really? You do?
I do.
I think
they will take up some sort of a criminal justice review. Now, how much that does, whether it translates into changing in mandatory minimums, there might be the sense of giving some latitude back to judges, again, that was taken away back in the early 90s. That's been sort of a sore spot for a long time. The problem is there's always, you know, you see this in the media all the time. You have a judge who either makes a poor decision in sentencing, or perhaps makes a sentencing decision that is based on factors that are not made known to the public, just because of the way the story is presented to the media. And legislators immediately rush to say, we got to do something about this. We need to have mandatory minimums. And the problem with mandatory minimums is that, and I know judges who are real strong conservative, hang 'em high type judges who absolutely hate the idea because they bring in people under circumstances who really the law was not meant to address. It's mandatory minimums are very much a blunt instrument, and I don't think do a lot for actually fixing the problem. We'll see it, but I'm less concerned about Jeff Sessions doing something on his own because look, at the end of the day, Trump is still his boss. And the other piece is he actually, you know, the laws are on the books and he's got to enforce those as they are written. So, so we'll see, but I think he may surprise you.
Well, I hope so. It seems like the theme of this episode maybe is that you kind of coming across, as I say, the cockeyed optimist and me being a little more pessimistic about that. And once again, I hope you're right, Jay. I don't think I've said I hope you're right more times ever than I have in this episode, but I do, in fact, hope you're right. You know, I noticed that we're running a little long today, so we won't have time to get the listener mail, but we will get to your listener mail next week. And so that pretty much does it for this week's episode.
I want to make one statement, though, that you and I should both react to is
okay.
Fidel Castro is dead.
Yes, he is.
And I'm happy for it. So I know other people might feel differently, but I think this is one of these is really sort of a monster of a human being. And if you consider the left, the criticisms of Trump that he wants to build a wall to keep people out, consider that Castro killed people who would try to leave, and just get the difference of no matter how bad you think Trump may be, he's not trying to kill any one of the Hollywood celebrities who are running to Canada. He's not sinking their ships in shark infested waters.
Sure.
I think we need to have a reckoning with the Castro legacy. And the other, you know, piece of this is that he did all this stuff right on our doorstep. So I say Fidel Castro, good riddance.
Well, you know, I think that Fidel Castro was a guy who came into power against working, understand with good, I think, motives of trying to fight back against a corrupt, awful, repressive regime, much like Robert Mugabe did in Zimbabwe. And I think it really shows to me more
both
than
good
anything.
Guys. Well, good
well,
guys.
Well, I think they both came in as reformers with high ideals, but I think this shows what happens.
Much like Lenin or Robespierre
Okay, yeah, there are a lot of examples, but my point, and you're kind of helping prove my point, and I appreciate it, is that this is what happens when there is not a strong opposition that is allowed to, well, be in opposition. When you don't have a tradition of that, when that's not built in, baked into your system, even people with the best of intentions, the best of ideals, end up going bad. And I think that's the genius of the American system, and that's why, you know, for all the people on the left who are freaked out that Donald Trump's going to be another, you know, fill in the blanks, Mussolini, some people talk about Hitler. I think it's ridiculous. But that's why in the end, I'm not nearly that worried. I think our system is, regardless of what you think about Donald Trump, I think our system is robust enough to, you know, to deal with more or less any kind of candidate that we can throw at it. And so in the end, I'm kind of a cockeyed optimist, maybe myself. I'm not concerned. We're going to be just fine in the long run, is my view.
Well, so I think that's good. And again, I'm optimistic that Fidel Castro is dead. So
we're pretty sure about
Chase
that.
Thing of, yeah, Francisco Franco is still dead. Fidel Castro is still dead. We might close the show with that or open the show with that for a while. So,
well, that'll be interesting. All right. Well, that's it for this week's episode. Thanks, everyone, for listening. If you have any thoughts, comments, criticisms, or questions for us on Ask the Politics Guys, we would love to hear from you. Our email is mail@politicsguys.com. And our Facebook page where we post stuff throughout the week is facebook.com/politicsguys. And we're also on Twitter @politicsguys. You know, we'd really appreciate it if you could subscribe to the show and leave a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast service you might be using. And sharing and retweeting our new show posts and tweets also really does help out a lot. And if you'd like to support the show financially, you can do that through the PayPal or Patreon links on our website. The Politics Guys will be back next Sunday. We hope you'll join us.